Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. A live report from the Dirksen Federal Courthouse as Michael Madigan faces questions from prosecutors in his corruption trial. The CTA's president says he's stepping down, a look at the projects he oversaw and why critics wanted him gone. CTU President Stacey Davis Gates on contract negotiations, education equity, and more in a one-on-one conversation.
Becoming and remaining a sanctuary city has been a bit of a mayoral tug of war.
And amid an effort to scale back protections for undocumented immigrants, a look at how Chicago became a sanctuary city in the first place. First off tonight, Michael Madigan made headlines last week when he took the stand in his corruption trial. Madigan is facing bribery, racketeering, and wire fraud charges. He and longtime right-hand man Michael McLean, who is also charged, have pleaded not guilty. Today, prosecutors got their chance to cross-examine the famously tight-lipped former Illinois House Speaker. Our Matt Masterson joins us now from the Dirksen Courthouse with more. Matt, today the prosecution played a wiretapped phone call of the former Illinois House Speaker. What did they hear?
Yeah, so Brandis, that call involved a conversation from 2018 between Madigan and his longtime confidant and current co-defendant Michael McLean, in which they commented about ComEd consultants who were working without, they were being paid without essentially doing any work for the company. This tape had previously been excluded from court, but when Madigan took the witness stand last week to testify that he was very angry when learning that these consultants were not doing the work that they were supposed to be doing, the judge reconsidered and allowed this tape to be let in. Now, on the tape, Madigan can be heard saying that these men made out like bandits while doing very little work. And while he had testified that he was very angry with this, he was laughing with McLean while they talked about this on this secretly recorded call. So it's definitely a major piece of the prosecution's case that it was only admitted because Madigan decided to take the witness stand.
Matt, there was also some back and forth between the attorneys in the case this morning. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, the attorneys on both sides spent the entire morning going over a host of legal issues before the jury was brought in. They discussed the admissibility of this very bandits tape if it was going to be allowed in court. They discussed also a push from the defense to admit tax return information from disgraced former 25th Ward Alderman Danny Solis, who was one of the government's star witnesses, recorded several secret recordings for the government. And the defense will be allowed to show these documents, which show that he lied on his tax returns in previous years as a way to try to discredit him and his testimony against Madigan.
And what did we hear from Madigan in his testimony today?
Yeah, some of the most contentious testimony came right at the end of the day where he was actually discussing Solis. So one of the main issues that Madigan is facing is that he was trying to trade public action for private gain from his law firm. So Solis had mentioned to him the possibility of a quid pro quo, doing tax work for Madigan's legal firm in exchange for Danny Solis approving a zoning change for a Union West development in his ward. Madigan last week testified that he was surprised and concerned when he heard that Solis used this term quid pro quo, but prosecutors today confronted him with this, saying that he had discussed this multiple times with Solis, that he hadn't pushed back on it for four separate conversations that they had each other until they finally met in person and Madigan told him that you shouldn't be using that language. But even so, Madigan later, the following year, was still willing to recommend Solis for a state board position. But he ultimately did not do so because Solis's work as an undercover mole eventually became public and Madigan backed off of that recommendation.
And Matt, before we let you go, what can we expect next?
Yeah, so Madigan is going to be back on the witness stand in the morning. His cross-examination is still going on. The attorneys hope that they're going to be able to get through all the testimony this week and that closing arguments will begin next week in this months-long trial. We're entering month three here, but they expect that the jury could get the case as soon as the week after next.
All right, a lot of time in the courthouse for you there. Matt Masterson, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can catch up on the trial on our website at WTTW.com/news. And now to some of today's top stories. A coalition of immigrant rights organizations are protesting a proposed change to Chicago's Welcoming City Ordinance.
This amendment is a step backwards, a concession to xenophobia and fear that has no place in our city. As an undocumented person, I feel safer because of the Welcoming City Ordinance. This policy is not just a symbol. It has a tangible impact on our lives.
The proposal from 15th Ward Alderman Raymond Lopez and 23rd Ward Alderwoman Silvana Tavares would reverse an amendment prohibiting Chicago police officers from cooperating with federal immigration agents in all cases. It's set for a vote this Wednesday. Members of the coalition say that proposal would further President Trump's anti-immigrant agenda and make immigrant communities fearful of calling 911. And later in the broadcast, find out how Chicago became a sanctuary city in our latest WTTW News Explains series. It might have looked like the NASCAR racetrack this morning for drivers who take the Kennedy Expressway, since the express lanes reopened this morning for the first time since last spring. Though I'm sure everyone respected the speed limit today, right? The ongoing Kennedy project has been in the works since 2023 as crews rehabilitate bridges and pavement, install new structures and signage, modernize electrical components, and more. While the express lanes were finally reopened today, construction on the outbound lanes of the Kennedy will begin later this spring. And remembering two influential Chicagoans who died recently. One of them, a member of the WTTW-WFMT family, Daniel Levin, died at his home after a brief illness at the age of 94. Levin was the founder and CEO of East Bank Club, an enormous development project that was considered ahead of its time in 1980 when it was founded. As a real estate developer, he also founded and chaired the Habitat Company, one of the Midwest's largest development and property management companies. Among other community and civic commitments, Levin served as a trustee to WTTW and our sister radio station, WFMT, for 47 years, chairing the WFMT radio committee for many of those years. In 2001, WFMT unveiled the Faye and Daniel Levin Performance Studio, made possible with support from the Levins. Levin is survived by his wife, former Ambassador Faye Hartog Levin, their children and grandchildren. Also, the founder of the Young Lords organization, Jose Chacha Jimenez, has died. In the late 1960s, the Young Lords began as a street gang of young Puerto Rican men in the Lincoln Park neighborhood. Jimenez led the conversion of that gang into a political organization to protest police harassment and the police killings of two young Puerto Rican men. Modeling the Lords after the Black Panther Party, they also fought against urban renewal, which often pushed Puerto Rican families out of their homes, as well as established a breakfast program for children and childcare for working families. Jimenez was 76 years old. And visit our website for a Chicago Stories documentary on the Young Lords of Lincoln Park. That's at WTTW.com/Chicago Stories. Up next, more on CTA President Dorval Carter's resignation. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Longtime Chicago Transit Authority President Dorval Carter is set to leave his job at the end of the month. Carter has led the agency for nearly a decade after his appointment by former Mayor Rahm Emanuel. His tenure was marked by major infrastructure projects, including the upcoming Red Line extension. But in recent years, he's faced widespread criticism for issues like unreliable service and inconsistent communication. Our Nick Blumberg joins us now with more. Nick, did Carter say why he's resigning?
He didn't, although that Red Line extension project that you mentioned, that has been a major priority of his for many years. Last week, local and federal officials gathered for a ceremony to sign off on the $1.9 billion in federal funding needed to help pay for the project. That deal was inked on Friday. This morning, we got word from the CTA that Carter's leaving on January 31st. In a statement, Carter said, "Serving as president of this great agency has been an extraordinary privilege, and I am forever grateful for what has been the opportunity of a lifetime. It has been an honor to work on behalf of CTA customers and to advance our mission in a city that I love so dearly." Now, Carter first started working at the CTA in the 80s as a staff attorney. He's been there on and off for a total of 26 years.
And Nick, we briefly mentioned it at the top, but remind us of some of the criticism that Carter's been facing.
Well, a lot of it began during the worst of the COVID-19 pandemic. The CTA kept running a full schedule because it was the only way for a lot of essential workers to get around. But a shrinking CTA workforce that actually predated the pandemic was exacerbated by bus and train operators calling into work or leaving their jobs altogether without hiring that kept pace. And that created a lot of anger around unreliable service, long wait times, other things like the so-called ghost buses and trains, fears about customer safety, complaints about cleanliness. Now, in recent months, Carter says increased hiring has allowed the agency to restore its service to pre-pandemic levels, though, of course, whether the agency always delivers its scheduled service is another matter. Now, Carter's had a very contentious relationship with some members of the city council in recent years. Here's a bit of a meeting last May where he pushed back about as forcefully as he ever had in public.
It's very easy to find someone to blame for everyone's troubles and challenges. It's much harder to find people that work to find solutions to them. I've been committed to finding a solution to problems ever since I came to this agency. I think my track record on that has been pretty good. I have been turned into a caricature. I have been turned into something that is less than a human being.
During his tenure, Carter oversaw some major projects like the Red Purple modernization effort. There's that new Green Line station that just opened at Damon, a plan to make all CTA stations fully accessible. But the agency's also facing a fiscal cliff of more than $500 million when COVID relief money runs out next year. State lawmakers are considering a plan to merge CTA, Metra, PACE, and the RTA, which, as we've reported on, Carter and his peers oppose. Now, some of those lawmakers have also floated the idea that boosting funding for transit should be tied to a leadership change. Here's what Mayor Johnson said about that last week.
We're certainly not going to acquiesce to those levels of constraints. Here's what we're committed to. Is making sure that the Chicago Transit Authority is fully funded so that we can have affordable, reliable, and safe transportation.
Carter plans to take a job as president of St. Anthony Hospital on the west side, where his father practiced medicine for four decades. Mayor Brandon Johnson now gets to pick his replacement. And Brandis, I'm sure a lot of people are very interested to see who that will be.
I am sure they are, and I'm sure you will bring it to us when the time comes. Nick Blumberg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you can read Nick's full story on our website. It is all at WTTW.com/news. After months of negotiations, the Chicago Teachers Union and Chicago Public Schools still have not reached a contract deal. Meanwhile, the CPS Board of Education's publicly elected members will be sworn in on Wednesday, and the district will be on the search for a new leader since the current board fired CEO Pedro Martinez just before the holidays. Joining us to discuss the state of negotiations and more is Stacey Davis Gates, Chicago Teachers Union president. Stacey, welcome back.
Hey, thank you for having me.
How would you describe the progress of contract negotiations at this point?
It's not moving fast enough. We were doing good work, successful movement back and forth before the CEO received his temporary restraining order. That slowed progress significantly, almost to a halt. You know, we had members at the table today who provided, you know, their level of frustration. Many of the things that we're pushing for, we want in place before number 47 is inaugurated. Title IX was struck down last week. We have real concerns about our queer and transgender students here in the city. Ray Lopez has introduced legislation that would make Chicago a co-conspirator in deporting our students and their families. We don't know what that looks like in a school community. These are things that we have to settle at the table to codify and build a force field around our school district.
And, of course, the temporary restraining order that you're referring to is the one that CEO Pedro Martinez received from court so that he would be the one negotiating with you all, not the board members who were recently seated, not the ones that are going to be taking the oath this Wednesday, of course. So a few things that you all are asking for in your contract. 5% raises annually for the first 2 years of the contract, 4 to 5% raises for years 3 and 4 of the contract. District says it is offering 4% because that's all it can afford. You're also asking for more fine arts and library, 20 minutes of prep time for teachers, as well as 200 librarians for the district approximately, and a nurse in every school. What's been the district's response on these presentations, proposals?
The district is still living from a very marginal perspective of how we offer the best type of public education for all of our students here in this city. Listen, a contract is over a multi-year plan. And what we are trying to do is do what we did in 2019. In 2019, we implemented a plan that put nurses and social workers in our school, that put restorative justice coordinators, that gave more to the student when they returned from COVID. And when they returned from COVID, they had the staffing, the support, and the resources that they needed to overcome a lot of the deficits that many other districts are dealing with. That is what we are trying to do here, build off of those gains, create an unmovable infrastructure. Already we think that what we've landed with them with sports is will be like iconic and legendary as it compares to what we've had previously. However, only 12 of our high schools have school libraries. And to be very frank with you, the way in which the district evaluates its teachers puts black teachers or teachers who teach at a majority black school in peril. Their ratings are a lot lower. This is not our data or research. This data was commissioned by the Illinois General Assembly. This data comes from a study at the University of Chicago. We are trying to work with the district to replenish the number of black teachers that were fired. We used to have almost 50% black teachers in the city of Chicago. Now we're hovering just under 19%. The district has to work with us. For the last few years, we have been incubating and supporting black teachers to get through that process. But that process is arduous, is biased, and it's unfair. We need a fix in our contract.
Of course, you know, we have to pay for all of this, right?
Yeah.
So part of your argument...
Well, that's a non-economic issue, Brandis.
Of course.
And if I can be completely transparent with you, the push and pull at the table right now is not over the economics. It is over academic freedom. We want to make sure that our young people and our members are able to engage in a complete dimensional history of our country. It's teacher preparation time. When you come to the studio, you don't just jump in this chair and, you know, do an interview with the president of the Chicago Teachers Union. You prepare for that. That's the same thing that our members want to do. They want to prepare to receive the young people. So all of what we're talking about is doable because we have the time already in our schedule. We do not have to marginalize instructional time. We can do this work. These are non-economic.
That said, though, part of your argument, though, is that the district is not, in fact, broke. CPS leadership, though, they held a press conference late this afternoon to explain some of the district finances.
First of all, $1.1 billion in reserves. That notion is just is flat out not true. It is based on a snapshot in time, not fully accounting for revenues and expenses in the fiscal year. And I can let my team go into more detail in Q&A, but the reality is we have $66 million of cash on hand, and that's 3 days of operating revenue, as you heard our CFO. If we had $1.1 billion in reserves sitting in the bank, we would not be taking out a loan of over $1 billion in tax anticipation loans to make payroll while we're waiting for property taxes to come in. There is no mythical pot of gold.
All right, so I also want to add on to that before we run out of time, because the Civic Federation released a report today as well, and a little bit of that says, the quote, the existing fiscal year 2025 CPS budget is structurally imbalanced, heavily relying on temporary revenues and lacking provisions for impending collective bargaining costs. These financial strains, coupled with long-term issues such as declining enrollment, rising expenditures, pension liabilities, and looming credit downgrades, demand immediate and strategic action. To stabilize CPS, the board must implement a forward-looking financial plan addressing budget deficits with cost-saving measures, operational efficiencies, sustainable revenue sources, and advocacy for increased state support. What do you make of both of these assessments from the district and the one from the Civic Federation, which sort of supports what the district is claiming?
So let me answer this in two ways. In the first bucket, I will say that everything that is at the table that needs settling right now, the real issues are non-economic. So those two press conferences are moot when it comes to settling this contract. The settlement of this contract will be about the non-economic issues that empower our educators, protect our freedoms, and make sure that our students get their supports. Those are non-economic. now to the press conference and the Civic Federation. The Civic Federation for years has argued for the closing of black schools. They've argued for underpaying women. They've argued for stealing people's retirement security. So this makes sense for them to say. This is what they always say. Number two, Pedro's assessment of the finances of the Chicago Public Schools without our contract is dire. No one can argue facts. But here's the question that I think we need to ask ourselves as Chicagoans. So I think we really want to... The Chicago Public Schools needs leadership that is going to be visionary enough to sustain it for the long term. This contract is a snapshot in time. The sustenance and the sustainability of this school district is something else. So he has to do a few things. Number one, he has to leverage the fact that he just received the largest TIF surplus ever in the history of this city. Number two, by 2031, that TIF will be nearly $1 billion. He has to count those things. Here's the other thing that he needs to do. He needs to figure out how to get a reimbursement for Medicaid so he can pay for the social workers we need for our students. And then here's the next thing. He needs to be very clear about advocating for both progressive revenue and for the Illinois General Assembly and the governor of this state to fund our schools.
That said, the state is also facing a $3.2 billion shortfall, but we've only got a couple seconds left, and I want to get your response on this. Obviously, last week it was reported that you compared CPS CEO Pedro Martinez to a special education student that can't be suspended. Of course, you know, there's a statement that we received from Equip for Equality, excuse me, a nonprofit disability advocacy agency, which our viewers can see online. I want to give you the opportunity to respond to all of this. How do you plan on rebuilding trust with parents and students after this incident? Obviously, you apologized immediately last week as well.
First off, I am extraordinarily embarrassed. It does not reflect my values or my body of work. I am deeply sorry for it. And I am going to be in a process of speaking to the advocates, families, students, our members about how to repair the harm. I am absolutely open for that. And further, our union is going to redouble its efforts to make sure that the Chicago Public Schools actually supports the special education students that we do have, because we do have a track record in that work.
Okay. Stacey Davis-Gates, Chicago Teachers Union President, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Good luck in your negotiations. Up next, what it means for Chicago to be a sanctuary city. But first, a look at the weather. As we mentioned earlier, some city council members are trying to scale back protections for undocumented immigrants in Chicago. The proposal comes from two older people who have long opposed the city's status as a self-proclaimed sanctuary city. The move comes as President-elect Donald Trump has promised to launch mass deportations in his second term. But how exactly did Chicago become a sanctuary city, and what does it mean? Joanna Hernandez explores the topic in our WTTW News Explains series.
For four decades, Chicago has held the designation of a sanctuary city. But what does it mean, and how has Chicago's status endured? The term sanctuary city refers to any jurisdiction that discourages, limits, or denies cooperation with federal immigration authorities. There are currently hundreds of sanctuary communities in America and 13 sanctuary states. Where do they come from? While Berkeley, California claimed the title of first sanctuary city in 1971, the sanctuary city movement really began popping up across the country in the mid-1980s. As President Reagan focused on identifying and deporting undocumented immigrants, churches opened their doors to provide shelter and resources for Central Americans fleeing civil war and violence. In Chicago, becoming and remaining a sanctuary city has been a bit of a mayoral tug of war. Mayor Harold Washington first declared Chicago a sanctuary city in 1985 via executive order. The order prohibited police and city employees from questioning residents about their immigration status and terminated cooperation with federal immigration authorities. Some argued the policy shielded convicted criminals from deportation. And in the 1990s, Mayor Richard M. Daley interpreted the policy to allow city officials to provide immigration information to the feds if the subjects were involved in serious crimes. Chicago's sanctuary policies went from executive order to a strong law with the 2006 Welcoming City Ordinance. In 2012, Mayor Rahm Emanuel and the City Council weakened the law, allowing police to work with federal officials in limited cases. Upon election in 2016, President Donald Trump threatened sanctuary cities with the loss of federal dollars. Nevertheless, the Chicago City Council voted to reaffirm the ordinance. Under Mayor Lori Lightfoot, an expanded welcoming ordinance closed the loopholes opened by Daley and Emanuel, banning all police cooperation with federal immigration authorities. As Chicago enters its 40th year as a sanctuary city, Mayor Brandon Johnson has reaffirmed Chicago's commitment. And today, thousands of refugees and undocumented immigrants have found a safe haven in Chicago. A point of pride for those who believe offering sanctuary is a matter of human rights, and a point of consternation for those who see it as a hurdle for law enforcement.
And you can find the rest of our Emmy-winning WTTW News Explained series on our website. And that's our show for this Monday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm, and proud sponsor of programming that offers advice and strategies to enhance the physical and mental well-being of fellow legal practitioners in Illinois.